Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is John V. Kachuba, writer and creative writing instructor at Ohio University. And we're talking about his latest book, Shapeshifters, A History. John, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's a pleasure to be here.
By the way, I didn't do the cheap route, and I didn't do this before Halloween to, like, just celebrate that. I just want to let you know that I did that on purpose because I thought this was a worthwhile book beyond the Halloween interest.
Yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, it does appeal to my typical audience.
Don't go there.
Beyond that.
Yeah. Halloween's for amateurs. The first and foremost, when you said the word shapeshifter and the way you use it in the book, what I was really surprised about, and it was interesting, is the broad range of subjects that you consider under the purview of this book. Because you even go as far as talking about Comic-Con cosplay and stuff like that. And I found that it made sense, but I had never really sort of seen that all lumped together under shapeshifting before.
Right, right. Well, when people think of shapeshifters, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind, if they know what a shapeshifter is a werewolf.
Right.
You know, there's so much popular thing. Oh, yeah, werewolf. I know all about that. But I was more interested in looking at sort of the, if you will, kind of the psychology of shapeshifting. Like, what does it mean to be a shapeshifter? Why is that character so popular in cultures all around the world? And so by doing that, the definition sort of enlarged on its own because I realized, you know, this could be considered, like you said, cosplay. That could be considered shapeshifting. Halloween. We don't want to talk about Halloween, but when you put on a costume and a mask, what are you doing? You know, you're changing your personality. You're becoming something else, at least for an hour or two. You know.
Well, you talk about that in the beginning of the book and then throughout. It really is probably one of the most primal aspects that you talk about shapeshifting, shaking off the constraints of society and the bonds of morality. The first thing I thought of, and you do cover this in the book, is Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It sort of really gets to the heart of the sort of psychology of shapeshifting.
Right, exactly. I think that is probably the quintessential shapeshifter. And if you know that story, I mean, Dr. Jekyll was this upstanding moral citizen, a doctor, a good guy in all regards, yet somewhere deep within, he had this urge to say or to think about, what would it be like if I could shake off the bonds of morality, of religion, of society, and just go crazy, do whatever I wanted to with no repercussion? Well, it didn't work out well for him. But, I mean, I think that is sort of a hidden desire in a sense that we all have. You know, luckily, we keep it under control, most of us.
But that's like a theme in so many things. Just as you were talking about that, I thought of Forbidden Planet. Because the whole idea of that is that they invent this thing that allows the id, monsters from the id, as they talked about it in the movie, to come out and destroy the entire planet. So the thing that they were always hiding inside of them, it's very Freudian, very Jungian, that's inside of you, comes out during these shapeshifters.
Right, exactly. And of course, Jung and Freud do get a mention in my book as well as some other psychologists and psychiatrists, because there is a deep psychology behind this.
It's almost as... Does every culture have stories about some kind of shapeshifting? You know, you go through huge examples from all over the world in this book, and it's almost easier to name the cultures that wouldn't have shapeshifting, and I don't know what those would be.
That's about what I thought, too. You know, for the research, I was in 8 different countries in Europe. I was in 5 countries in Asia. So I looked at a lot of cultures, and you're exactly right. I found them everywhere, in every continent, and going back from ancient times, I mean prehistoric times. The earliest example I have in my book is a Neolithic cave drawing showing a shaman changing into a deer. You know, so it goes way back, and I found it in virtually every country, every culture that I looked at, and not just one type of shapeshifter, but frequently several within one culture.
And there also may be shapeshifting as far as gender transformations that occur too.
Yes. In fact, I mean, there's a Greek myth of Tiresias who changes from a man to a woman and back to a man again, not by will. Apparently, it's a curse from the gods, but it happens nonetheless. But I also even talked a little bit about the issues of transgender.
Right.
And I didn't want to get too deep into that because I'm not an authority on that field. But in a way, that's sort of the ultimate shapeshifting. If you know that you are not in the correct body, so to speak, and you want to change yourself, there it is. I mean, that too is something that is shapeshifting.
And the Bible is not is not exempt from this either. And I'm sure there are a lot of Christians that may be surprised that shape-shifting's in the Bible.
Yeah, there's some Old Testament examples. I mentioned Daniel, where King Nebuchadnezzar is changed into some type of a beast. It almost sounds like a wolf, but it's hard to say, but he's in there. But then to upset Christians a little further, and I don't really mean to, there are some theologians, at least one in particular from the Netherlands, that supposes or throws out there the proposition that Jesus may have been a shapeshifter based on an ancient Coptic text that he found in the Morgan Library that he's translated. So, there's that. And if you look at other gods, the Buddha had at least, I think, two transfigurations in his lifetime, according to Buddhist lore. What is that about? A transfiguration is an ultimate shape-shifting. You have it in Hinduism with the seven avatars.
That's right.
It's in a lot of different religions as well.
Now, let's talk about classical Greece for a while, because I consider that a golden age of shape-shifting. And one of the great summaries of all the shapeshifting is, if you've never read this, people, make sure you read it. It's referenced in your book, John, is Ovid's Metamorphosis, which is basically a compendium of shapeshifting.
Yeah. It's like the ancient Funk and Wagnall shapeshifter,
But let's talk about Zeus, who was a real scum. And thanks to his ability at shapeshifting, he was really like... He was a serial rapist, is what he was.
He was. And what I can't understand is, so in my book, I list maybe 12 transformations that he made.
Well, let's go through some of them, because he became a cuckoo bird, a swan, an ant, a maiden, my favorite, golden shower.
Right.
Not that kind. But, right. And all to just seduce mortal women.
Right. And so I have two questions. First of all, he's a god. Why would he have to do that? That's the first thing. He's the god of gods, right? He's the father of the gods. Why would he have to do that? The second thing is, what's with these women that are okay with the animal stuff? I mean, that's just another question I had. I don't even want to get into that one.
I think things were a lot different in ancient times. I think it was okay to like get on with a swan.
I think so.
Well, you know, the golden shower one is I'm forgetting her name right now. But that was just sort of this weird thing that she was standing there and this shower of gold, like literally gold, the element, comes down on top of her. And I think a lot of times people weren't even aware of the fact that they were being impregnated. And they give birth to a mortal, part human. I mean, part a god.
Right.
What
a demigod, yeah.
Yeah, and Hera was not too happy about any of this.
No. And unfortunately for some of the people that Zeus had relationships with, I mean, she would punish them. You know, it's like, oh, wait a minute. I mean, you know, Zeus came and did his thing. I was just kind of an innocent bystander. But, you know, she was a pretty jealous wife.
Now, what I know about the ancient Greeks and other ancient cultures, too, is that people thought transformations like this were possible. And that's why they thought like rotted meat could change into maggots. And so this wasn't just sort of people creating a wonderful little, fairy tale. This was really possible, that if you really felt things very strongly, you could physically change.
True. And it wasn't just, we think of them as tales. We call them mythology. But, for the people of those times, it was more than that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, these were their gods and goddesses. This was their religion. So, they believe that absolutely, that this could happen.
One of my favorite ones, and I don't think it's mentioned in your book, is the fall of Phaethon, the kid who takes his father's sun chariot out. And when he crashes, first of all, he looks like a shooting star. But his brother is Cygnus the Swan. His brother sees him die, and then he just starts moaning and crying and making noises like a swan, and he is transformed into a swan, and his sisters weeping turn into willows. And it says Zeus put on his father put on a dark robe to mourn him, and that was an eclipse. And all of those were like incredible examples, and actually poetic examples, of shapeshifting.
Right, and also of explaining natural phenomena. Right?
Yeah, I know.
Stars, eclipses, a way of explaining it all. Yeah.
Now, in some cultures, though, shapeshifters are considered untrustworthy. Why?
Yeah, I mean, in some cultures, they're more like the trickster figure. You know, we have this misconception, I think, also too, that shapeshifters are by their nature evil in some way. And while that's true for a big majority of them, I found in my book a lot of shapeshifters that weren't necessarily evil at all. Some were fairies and other kinds of entities that could shapeshift that actually would sometimes do you favors or do good things for you. But untrustworthy because you never know. You never know what you're dealing with. You never know if you're dealing with a true person or if this is some, metamorphosed form of somebody. So you never know if you're getting the truth, if you're getting an honest relationship with whatever you're talking to. So by their nature, they're sort of untrustworthy.
That seems to be true, and you mentioned a lot of examples of this in classic European fairy tales. Like I think of things like Beauty and the Beast and the Frog Prince. Those are good examples of you're not really sure who you're dealing with there. You know, you got a frog that's telling you to kiss him and so and you,
right.
You're not really sure whether this should be happening or not. But that also points out, and you bring this out in the book, is that sometimes the shape-shifting is punishment.
Yeah, exactly. So I sort of have two rough classifications. I call them voluntary shapeshifters or involuntary. And when I think of voluntary, I think of shamans, wizards, witches, you know, whatever, people, gods. People that have the ability of their own to transform whatever they want to into whatever they want to. But then there's sort of the unfortunates that are the result of a curse or some misfortune where they, not that they want that, but they are transformed by some other power or some other person into something else. So Beauty and the Beast, the Beast was cursed. He was this handsome prince, ends up being cursed. Same thing for the Frog Prince. You know, he was, and I don't know what it is with princes always being cursed, but apparently there's a theme going there too.
It's the revenge of the serfs, is what it is.
I was going to say it might be a political statement.
I think it is.
But, a polemic, you know. But anyway.
Yeah, they're not writing the fairy tales. The princes aren't writing the fairy tales. It's the other people who are writing the fairy tales.
That's right.
It might be some kind of wish fulfillment, but it sort of sets up this thing where you can never be sure what you're looking at or interacting with. You never can be sure because it could be something else.
Right. And so a lot of times the shapeshifter stories that come out, especially the ones that are sort of popular folk tales in various cultures, they're actually instructive. You know, they're actually telling the listener that, okay, you need to be careful of that stranger, that he might be a handsome-looking guy, ladies, that comes into town, but, you know, he may actually be a beast under that. So there's actually these sort of hidden lessons for life that beware the stranger, the other.
Oh, yeah. Although that could be taken too far, too, and turn into real sort of paranoia about strangers, too. Like, I often wonder, like, you can imagine being a stranger wandering into some isolated European medieval town. I mean, people would probably burn you as some kind of weir pig or something like that.
Yeah, absolutely. Right.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is John B. Kachuba, writer and creative writing instructor at Ohio University. And we're talking about his latest book. It's really, there's a lot of great stories in this. Shapeshifters, A History. There's some classic stories that you recount and histories in the book. And I want you to talk about the berserkers, of the Norse traditions, because those are actually real people.
Right. So the berserkers were Scandinavian warriors from different nations up there who basically divide themselves almost into sort of two clans, I'll call them. There were the wolves and the bears for the most part. There were other ones too, but these are the two big ones. And what these guys would do is they would get themselves into a frenzy. I mean, they would get into sort of a trance state, probably aided by natural hallucinogenics.
Amanita muscaria. To this day, they still the Finnish-Ugaric tribes still take that. Yeah, that's a dangerous hallucinogen.
It is. Well, it is, and it's even more dangerous when you're wielding a sword or a broadaxe. You know,
everything is more dangerous when you're wielding a sword.
Yeah, for sure.
Picking your nose is dangerous when you're wielding a sword. But they would do that. They would bring them along as sort of the heavies.
Right, they were like the shock troops. I mean, they would put these guys out front, and you know, it was said that if you were an ally to these berserkers, that you would keep your distance because once they were in motion, once they were in action, anything in front of them would get cut down. They didn't see any difference between friend and foe. It got to the point where so bad that Scandinavian kings got together and even said, you know, we have to outlaw berserker bands. you know, because they were uncontrollable. They were wild men. But that's where we get our word berserk.
You know,
we say going berserk. That's where it comes from.
It's amazing because I've read accounts from the times. They would start foaming at the mouth and, you know, get a weird glazed look in their eye. And you're absolutely right. It's like basically you don't want to be anywhere near them. You just sort of push them to the front. have them go at it.
And this state would last sometimes for like a day. And then it said once it sort of they recovered in a way, they were useless. I mean, they're like totally exhausted for a while. They just couldn't do anything.
Well, you know, it's interesting because the theory is that they were taking massive amounts of Amanita muscaria mushrooms, which are deadly poisonous to us. But they would train, the shamans would train people to drink, this is true, the urine of people who had built up a resistance, and that the kidneys would filter out the poisons and keep in the hallucinogens.
Wow.
Yeah, I know.
That I didn't know.
No, as a matter of fact, if you look at the little golden guide to hallucinogenic plants, which is one of the golden guide series, they actually have a picture of somebody doing that. But by the way, I want, for the benefit of the audience, do not eat any Amanita mushrooms because you will die. And they would train people from very, very young taking tiny bits of it so that they could get it. But that's exactly the kind of reaction you would get. There is so many great sort of characters in your book, and let's talk about a couple of them. Kelpies. I've heard of them, and I loved reading the stories of them in your book. Who were the Kelpies?
The Kelpies were, let's see if I can get my story right. I have so many in there.
They're the water people. Yeah, the water people.
Yeah, so what they would do is this is primarily up in the British Isles and some of that area where they talk about Kelpies, and they would come to shore. They would transform into usually male, you know, men or women, and always described as beautiful women or very handsome men. And they would just sort of wander into the villages, and they would, you know, frequently find a spouse, and they sometimes would live in the villages for years as a human being. But that at some point, they would go back to the sea. They would, you know, the sea was like continually calling for them, and they would get back into their usually a seal skin and disappear into the water. But again, this is sort of a cautionary tale about the stranger coming into town, and especially for women, you know, don't pick up with some strange guy. Go to the village boy next door. He's trustworthy, you know. So there's those kinds of stories.
But it's interesting that you have so many stories of these shapeshifters who are associated with water.
Right.
And I often thought is because when people looked at water, can take on any shape. You can pour water in any shape vessel. And sort of that fluidity of water seemed like it would really lend itself to shapeshifting. But there are a lot of these water shapeshifters would lead people to their doom.
Yeah, right. I mean, actually, it's interesting. I just came from a conference in Georgia, the country, Georgia. And I gave a talk there on water spirits, particularly. So again, this was kind of a cautionary tale for the most part about leaving your people, leaving your village, and wandering out into places where you shouldn't be, namely dangerous lakes, dangerous rivers, or the treacherous seashore.
You know,
because there were all these creatures out there that would literally, you know, come and get you, and take your soul, take your body, just drown you. And again, a lot of it was seduction. You know, a lot of them were females who would seduce young guys who were out, you know, looking for a little adventure, and they'd get more than they bargained for. They would get seduced and get drowned.
And also, most people didn't probably swim at that point in time.
That's probably true. Yeah.
So that this was also a cautionary tale, but don't get too close to the water because weird things will come up and get you.
Right, and some of them, particularly interestingly enough, preyed on children, primarily.
Yeah.
And so, again, a lesson for the children. Don't leave your parents. Don't leave your village. Don't go wandering around where you don't belong. Stay put. So these were, I mean, I look at this, and I think that so many of these had lessons for a society, ways to behave. So they weren't just, you know, tales to tell around a campfire some night. They were actually instructive in some ways.
Now, you have some stories about some contemporary crazy people, conspiracy theorists. And I had heard about this, but I didn't know a lot of details of the Babylonian Brotherhood.
Yeah.
And I do know that there are people who believe that.
Yeah, there are. There are. So the short of it is there's a
short.
The short named David Icke, who has this whole theory, although I think, you know, theory might be even too generous a term, but he has this story about aliens that came to Earth from some star system, and I don't know what it is. He names it specifically. I don't remember what it was. But they came to Earth millions of years ago, and they mated with whatever sort of proto-humans were roaming around on our planet at that time. And so all these people, these aliens, by the way, were reptilian. They were shapeshifters. They can change their form from reptile to whatever they wanted. So now this reptilian alien shapeshifting gene is in a whole part of our population worldwide because it's been in our, you know, gene pool for millions of years, according to him. So there are people, according to this story, that are capable of – they're actually reptilian alien shapeshifters. They're capable of changing into a reptile, you know, a lizard man, whatever you want to call it, and back and forth to different shapes. And interestingly enough, he says that a lot of these people have gotten themselves into very important positions, such as Queen Elizabeth II. She's a shapeshifter. Barack Obama is a reptilian.
So this is where it becomes in sort of like an interesting sort of ultra extreme rightist political thing.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean,
now, I went actually after reading your book, I actually went to check out some of the photos from that. And they, right. they will have these like little photographs of people's eyes and then they think that they could see that moment where they suddenly flash the reptilian eye.
Right, they become this vertical iris.
I know.
You know, it's like, oh, look, I got a lizard. You know, it, like there's no such thing as photoshopping or anything. You know?
Oh, my God.
So, yeah.
But there are people who believe this.
There's millions of people that believe it. There's millions of people that subscribe to his website and get his newsletters and everything. Oh. Now, he talks about a lot of other conspiracies. This isn't his only story. But, yeah, millions of people still buy into that. And I, you know, I find it hard to believe.
Thank you. I would hope that. Now, there's yeah. somebody, you also, besides werewolves, you talk about vampires. And I want to talk about another contemporary group that's, I believe, is existing, but is very weird, the Sanguinarians.
Right.
They've sort of taken it upon themselves that they need blood.
Right. So there's at least two communities. There's one in New Orleans, and there's one in all places, Buffalo, New York, probably the last place in the world.
Well, you got nothing else to do in the winter. In winter, it's really a lot of snow and very cold.
And so maybe you can't get out for groceries, so you just rely on somebody's blood. I don't know. But, yeah, they actually claim that they have a physical, you know, medical need for human blood,
wow.
that they can't live without
wow.
it. But, you know, having said that, they don't go around in the night, you know, preying on people, jumping on them, biting their necks. I mean, they actually have volunteers or people that sort of, I don't know, associates or whatever, who willingly donate blood to them for those purposes. And they do it under hygienic, you know, protocols as if they were like, as if you're donating blood someplace. So, but yeah, they still believe that they need this and they ingest human blood. They don't really like to call themselves vampires but they are actually, in fact, taking somebody else's blood.
They call themselves sanguinarians.
Right. That's the term they use. Yeah. So it's interesting. There are communities like that.
Well, there was always been a lot of fear, and you talk about this in the book, of vampires. You know, you talk about the story of Vlad Tepes, who also was known as Vlad the Impaler, and how that eventually
right.
turned into. But there were people like Countess Bathory, who you mentioned, who really believed that the blood of young girls would keep her forever young.
Right, and she's documented. I mean, I don't know how many young women she killed.
A lot.
They say hundreds, if not thousands. Right, and she would bathe in their blood. I mean, it takes a lot of blood to fill a bathtub. You know, it takes a lot of bodies to do that.
It does.
And I mean,
do you know that for a fact?
Not through experience.
Okay, I just wanted to give you that out. I want to make sure that was really clear right then and there.
Thank you. We never know who's listening in.
That's right.
Yes, thank you. I have not killed anybody.
Good. Okay. We're clear on that. But that is as a matter of fact, that's been made into movies and stuff like that,
right.
and sensationalized,
right.
especially by Hammer Films.
Right.
The werewolf accounts, though, are really fascinating to read, of these werewolf accounts in the 1600s and 1700s, because it often sounds like it's a psychotic killer, and that people view
right.
it through the eyes of a shapeshifter. In other words, the only way they can understand it is to understand the psychotic killer as a shapeshifter.
Right. It does seem like, I'm not sure why that time period was so prevalent, but but it seems like there were several, you know, famous cases that I recount in the book in detail about people who believe that they had turned into wolves, to werewolves, and that they would kill people, and they would do it, you know, basically barehanded and eat them at times. I mean, just like a wolf would do. And, of course, a lot of them were brought to justice. Some were burned at the stake. Some were locked up in asylums. Just depended on the time of, you know, what the general population was thinking about them at the time. But, yeah, they were definitely suffering under some mental illness, and yet people would say, well, they must be werewolves, you know, because there's no other way to explain, I guess, such such a psychosis. I mean,
that's right.
It's crazy.
Well, and there was also fear of vampires, and there would be right. wasting diseases that would go through different villages, and people would exhume coffins, and they would look for the bodies that hadn't rotted properly.
Right, right. And a lot of that was, I mean, we know today that a lot of the wasting disease that they were laying at the foot of vampires was actually tuberculosis, consumption they called it, but then tuberculosis. And there was a famous case as late as the late 19th century in New England.
I mean, that's right, in Rhode Island. It happened in Rhode Island, and people were totally convinced that when they exhumed that corpse.
Mercy Brown, and
that's
right. I think she died in 1889, I think. I mean, it's fairly recent, and yet people still believe that vampirism was at work, that, you know.
We're almost out of time, but I just want to mention the great thing about you. So you go through all this gruesome, crazy stuff, and then you get to Transformers.
Yeah, I know.
And it does make sense, because once you've been reading about all these transformations, and then you have Transformers, and that's like the positive spirit of shapeshifting.
Yeah, well, and it gets even more into popular culture. I mean, I have 11 grandkids, and two of them are two little girls. And they clued me into Vampirina, a little cartoon series that's really cute, with this little vampire girl who changes into a bat.
I never heard of this.
Yeah. Well, another cartoon called Morphle, and Morphle is this little red, it's like a gumdrop. And some little girl owns him, and he's called a magical pet. And this little magical pet, his name is Morphle, M-O-R-P-H.
Oh, my God.
So even morphology is in there, right?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and he can change into a fire truck, a dinosaur, a dog, you name it.
It's the Wonder Twins, form of water.
Well, there you go.
So it's always been with us in like huge numbers of forms. It's amazing. There's so much stuff in this book. People have to read it. There's scary stories, bizarre stories, and fun stories too. This is like a huge compendium of just change.
Yeah.
my guest tonight is John B. Kachuba. He's a writer and creative writing instructor at Ohio University. And we're talking about his latest book. It's just a fun read, Shapeshifters, a History. John, it's a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It's been fun talking with you.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.